This is a CBC podcast.
Where do I belong? How do I belong? Do I belong? Whether you are a new Canadian or a new high school student, you have a story to tell. Share your personal story about belonging with the CBC for a chance to win one of two cash prizes from the Canada Council for the Arts. One Canadian aged 12 to 18 and one 19 and over will win $1,000 each. Deadline to submit is November 2nd. For more details, visit cbcbooks.ca.
Christianity in the West has had a tremendous problem. How to come to terms with the environment at a time when its most devout followers have not shown much interest in the environment. Take all the verses in the New Testament, there's no reference to nature.
I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas About Islam and the Environment.
The Quran addresses not only human beings, but also the cosmos. All creatures participate in Islam. It's much easier to be able to develop an environmental philosophy which would not be incongruent or artificial, as if you add an artificial tail to a donkey. It's part and parcel of the Islamic worldview.
Dr. Syed Hossein Nasser is one of the most prominent Islamic scholars in the world. He was born in Iran and holds undergraduate degrees in math and physics from MIT, a master's in geology, and a PhD in the history of science from Harvard. He now teaches at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C.
There's no issue more important in the world today, besides, of course, the spiritual life of man and woman, than the environment. To be modern is to destroy the world of nature. That's the great tragedy of it, and we shall try to find out why.
Dr. Nasser's interest in religion and nature spans five decades. As you'll hear later, his views have been both celebrated and censored. This is from a talk he gave at the Ismaili Center in the spring of 2014 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
I've not been to your city for 20 years, and I see half of the city is gone. Where did the trees go? Where all the beautiful forests that were around here disappeared? And boxes have taken the place which we call apartment houses. Ugliness that is not unique to your city, but is all over the world. Everywhere is the same, and the cause is the same. The divorce of our understanding of nature from the sacred and the spiritual.
On this episode of Ideas, you'll hear more excerpts from Dr. Nasser's talk, as well as from my conversation with him. This is Ideas on Islam and the Environment.
I've spent over 50 years thinking and writing and lecturing about this matter. From the days when, as a young student at Harvard and MIT, I used to walk alone around Walden Pond about 1 o'clock in the morning and meditating upon nature. That time until now, much of my intellectual activity and spiritual activity has been spent on this matter. As long as men lived according to religion, there was no environmental crisis. No one can deny that. 50 years ago, you could not find a single Christian theologian who tried to defend nature against its abuse from a Christian point of view. Why is this so? This is the same religion that produced Francis of Assisi, who would talk to the birds and wrote that beautiful address to the sun and the moon. Why did this happen? It was the rise of the scientific revolution. The fact that the Catholic Church burned its hands with the Galilean trials, and after that decided not to have anything more to do with the cosmos, with the world of nature. Protestantism, although early in the 16th century, including Martin Luther himself, who was a keeper of the fish. He was a keeper of the fish in a pond in Germany. Protestantism became very acosmic. It did not produce one single major thinker about nature. So what happened in the West is that in the 19th century, when a reaction was set in against this new ugly modernization and industrialization that people were seeing, the reaction didn't come from Christian circles. It came from people like William Blake. It came from people like Wordsworth. It came from Lord Alfred Tennyson. Tennyson was learning Arabic when he was going blind. He was not at all interested in Christianity anymore. Wordsworth wasn't either, and Blake was considered to be a pagan. All of you know this famous poem, Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright, poems like that which really praise the beauty of and power of nature. But the mainstream religion in Europe was concerned with other issues, theology, morality, politics, all kinds of other issues, and therefore leaving nature in the hands of two forces, a totally secularized science, which is modern science, which has nothing to do with the transcendent, to which the spiritual meaning of nature is totally irrelevant, is purely subjective or non-existent, and of course, greed.
Dr. Nasser, you said in the lecture that the spiritual life of anyone has nothing more important in it than the environment. We hear that kind of pro-environmental message quite a bit these days, but almost never, at least not in my mind, from an Islamic scholar. Why do you say that?
Because after the revelation, even according to Islam, the most important thing is God's other revelation, which is nature. In the Quran, nature is presented as being another revelation, in a sense, from God. And everything in nature speaks of the truth, which revelation in its particular sense of being revealed to human beings contains. And especially important for Muslims who have forgotten this, although both Arabic and Persian literature, as well as Turkish and others, have a lot of wonderful, beautiful poems and prose pieces about this truth, about the spiritual significance of nature.
I'm curious about what makes the relationship with the environment so spiritual for you personally.
From my childhood, I was always attracted to the beauty of nature. Every summer, my family would take me along a very high mountain, which is called Mount Damavand, the biggest mountain in Western Asia. And we had a big garden there, and I used to play there. And I felt very close to the trees, to the birds, to the animals, to the rocks and the mountains. And that love has remained with me all my life. It was abetted and fortified by my spiritual interests that began to flower. I was always nourished by the beauty of nature. When I was a student at MIT and Harvard, I traveled to almost all the major national parks, not only in New England, but also in Western United States, walked on long tracts of land and pristine, pure nature. And back in Iran also, I used to go mountain climbing all the time.
So it's something that you've had all your life. It's not something that you came upon later in life or as some sort of revelation.
No, I had that all my life. When I looked at the moon when I was as a child, I could speak to it, or the stars. I was always a very, I don't want to say naturalistic, but spiritual communion with nature, which goes back to my earliest years.
Now, you said in the speech that to be modern is to destroy the world of nature. I'm wondering, though, if it isn't almost the opposite. People these days, there's a huge bandwagon that people are jumping on to be green. There are marches for the environment, marches against climate change. In fact, it's considered to be old-fashioned now to deny climate change, and it's considered to be somewhat progressive to look towards a greener world.
This is a relative view of history. When I meant my modern, I meant what took place in Western civilization after the Middle Ages, and led to a purely secularist science and a technology which creates the ravaging of nature. And this, of course, both science and technology later on from the 19th century onward spread to Asia and other continents of the world and was not unique to Europe and North America. The worldview of modernism is against nature as a spiritual reality. Modern Western science is the first science created in the whole history of science, which looks upon the world of nature as matter in motion, as pure quantity, which puts aside all the qualitative aspects of nature, as Galileo and Descartes did. And therefore, a product of the science is a worldview from which the spiritual is banished. There is no spirit in the world of modern physics. But it's also interesting to add that people today who are great defenders of nature, there are people who are trying to rediscover the spiritual significance of nature, which was totally absent from the atomistic, materialistic worldview of 17th century physics and the other sciences.
I now want to ask you something about something very specific that you said. In a sense, it comes out of what you just said. I quote here, "As long as men lived according to religion, there was no environmental crisis." Can you explain that?
Yes, it's very simple. Destruction of streams, destruction of forests, but it was not a crisis yet. The crisis came about, actually, in the 20th century. And it did not come about in countries which had preserved the religious traditions. It came in countries which had decided to modernize. And it was not simply a particular theory of government and economics, let's say capitalism, but it was actually the practice itself. That is why some of the worst kind of industrial pollution occurred in the Soviet Union, which was then communist, and of course in communist China, which has had devastating effect. Now, all of these took place in a society which had marginalized religion. I do not say there were no religion left in Europe. Of course there was, or in America even more than Europe. But it's been marginalized. Religion has no role to play in what kind of factories you create, in what kind of productions you spread, in the economic life of the country. Whereas in traditional societies where religion was strong, there was no environmental crisis because of certain forms of technology were used, which were always friendly to nature. And the main message of religion was to live in harmony with nature, whether it's in Taoism or Islam or Hinduism or anything else.
Secularism was really born after the Middle Ages, but it went step by step. It wasn't that everything in Europe became immediately secularized. There are many villages until a few years ago in Italy before the television came in. I feel like medieval villages. People are still living in a religious world, in a sacred world. So it wasn't that it came immediately, but it went step by step. But the important thing is that it became the dominating paradigm. It took over the universities, the educational system, and therefore people were trained, children were trained, no matter what their parents taught them at home, a secularized view of the world of nature. So even those who were Christian and went to church on Sunday, from Monday until Saturday, they lived in a secularized world. Very little challenge came from the Christian side of what was happening to God's creation.
I'm Paul Kennedy, and on Ideas, you're listening to renowned Islamic scholar and environmentalist, Dr. Syed Hossein Nasser. He was speaking at the Ismaili Center in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Two-thirds of all the world's problems today involve religion. But no one ever teaches religion at political science departments. That's taboo. That's taboo, as if it didn't exist. So writing about Vancouver without writing about rain. Thank God we've had no rain the last 2 days. But in the long run, I don't want to insult your beautiful city, but it's like that. How can you teach political science, government, in a place like Harvard University or Columbia, these major American universities, as if religion didn't exist? Whereas three-fourths of all the problems that exist in the world today, even what's happening in Burma, the massacre of Muslims, has something to do with religion. Not only the Palestinian-Israeli question, all the what's going on inside the Islamic world, but also outside of the Islamic world, between India and the Muslim and the Buddhist and all kinds of things in Africa, everywhere you see this going on. There are very few, very, very few, in fact, conflicts which do not involve religion. And when they do, sometimes when it's politically expedient, it's hidden, like what's happening in Ukraine now. But one of the most important problems, the difference between Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, or Ukrainian Orthodox Christians, and the Catholic Orthodox, that is Orthodox Catholic, who are on the side of the Vatican. And this goes back to medieval history. I haven't seen a single word about this in any American press. But it's there, almost every conflict today. In a sense, religion came back in the 20th century. But the sciences that came out during the secularist period usually left religion on the side. Everything became secularized until finally the study of religion itself became secularized. What's going on now in American and Canadian universities in which you teach religion on the condition you don't believe in it. It's like teaching music on the condition of being musically deaf. That's only done for the field of religion, but not for any other field. So in such an atmosphere, everything that was looked upon intellectually from the secularist point of view. Western philosophy became secularized. Western sociology, psychology, various disciplines. And it was quite obvious, therefore, that the environmental crisis could never be seen as a crisis from a secularist point of view, because if you do not accept the sacred quality of nature, if that is destroyed, nothing is destroyed. It didn't exist to start with. You only talk about certain parameters until human life itself becomes threatened, until ecosystems become threatened. And that happens gradually in the early 20th century, and the very word ecology enters into the English language in a new meaning, which now we call environment. Before it used to be called ecological studies, environmentalists have come to the fore, but dominated by secularism. So there's no doubt about that, that the beginning of study of the environment in the West begins from a secular point of view.
Dr. Nasser, you say that science has become secularized and it had nothing to do with transcendence. But I'm wondering if that isn't exactly what science is supposed to do. It sets out to study the physical and natural world through observation and experiment. Isn't that what science is all about?
No. This is our modern definition of science. The word science, of course, comes from Latin, scientia. And if you look at the medieval texts in which this word is used, it meant really organized knowledge, and it was always connected to higher levels of knowledge through classifications of the sciences, highest forms of knowledge being knowledge of the spiritual world, metaphysics, or knowledge of God. What modern science did from the 17th century onward, not all of its practitioners, so Isaac Newton, for example, didn't want to do this, but they did it in spite of himself, was to cut a particular domain of reality called the physical world from higher domains of reality, and either deny the existence of those higher domains of reality or consider them to be irrelevant to the study of science. So science became a study of a closed domain of reality called the physical, whereas in fact, metaphysically, no domain of reality is completely closed unto itself. They all open up unto the infinite reality, which is God.
You're critical in the lecture of the Western intellectual and specifically religious tradition when it comes to the way we look at the environment. I'm also interested, though, in the fact that when we look at much of the Islamic world today, where the free flow of ideas in the traditional media or certainly in the social media is restricted, how do you combine those two things? How can one society be so open and so closed at the same time?
Let me start with the West. Medieval Christianity, and even during the Renaissance, many thinkers dealt with the spiritual significance of nature. Part and parcel of the general theology that was taught in Catholic seminaries throughout Europe. In the Renaissance, gradually, of course, there were views expressed which broke that medieval way of looking at nature, but even they were oftentimes very much interested in the spiritual significance of nature. The works of Nicholas of Cusa, Giordano Bruno, people like that. Then in the 17th century, with the Galileo trial, in which the Catholic Church's hands were burned, you might say, the Catholic Church decided to put aside its interest in nature. No more major Catholic theologian dealing with nature, a theology of nature, was produced during the next 300 years. And the Catholic Church said that Christianity is a religion of love. We don't care whether the world is square or trapezoid or anything else. That's the domain of science. And a partition took place in a philosophical sense between science and religion in the West. It was not until the environmental crisis came about that Catholic theologians realized that they had to do something. Protestant theologians were acosmic almost from the beginning. When my book, Man and Nature, which was the Rockefeller Series Lectures, University of Chicago in 1966, came out, it met with very strong opposition from both Anglican and Catholic writers. But 50 years later, things are very different. very, very different. There's a whole movement in Christian theology, both Catholic and Protestant, in order to recreate a kind of theology of nature. And it's a major aspect of religious thought in the West today.
I guess, Dr. Nasser, what I'm interested in is the conversation that is or is not going on in the Islamic world about nature, about the environment.
The environmental crisis began in the West. It was caused by modern Western civilization. Let's be honest about this. Had there not been modern industrial revolution, there would not have been the environmental crisis that we face. When it began, the other religions of the world were impervious to this. Their goal since the 19th century was to defend the religion against the onslaught of the West and of modernism. The energy of, let's say, Muslim scholars was spent on defending Islam against attacks of missionaries and Orientalists and things like that. They did not put their energy at all in trying to preserve the Islamic view of the natural environment. In places like Egypt, Iraq, Syria, Pakistan, even India, there was hardly any awareness. In India, of course, the Gandhi movement against modern industrialism had a very important environmental dimension to it. But the movement that we're talking about, sort of modern environmentalism, cut across Muslim-Hindu lines in India as well. We know that fully well. Gradually, then, a consciousness arose in the 1960s and 70s. Their argument was that, oh, the West polluted the world in order to get rich to carry out the Industrial Revolution. Now that it's our turn to do the same, they tell us not to pollute. We don't care. We're going to first industrialize, then we'll think of the pollution. This was the attitude. But gradually, even in Islamic countries, consciousness of this matter began to change. I was the first voice for a long, long time, for a couple of decades, who spoke about this. But then there came the Grand Mufti of Syria, Sheikh Ahmed Keftaru, who has died now, who was an unbelievable supporter of environmental issues. And gradually through him and other ulama, some of the religious scholars became interested. But he met with the great resistance of two groups of people. One was the modernized Iranians or Arabs or Turks who were sold on Western modernism, and the environmental crisis showed the failure of modernism in a very, very blatant way that it was going to lead to the death of the earth. Or is human life on earth? The second were very traditional ulama who had only been interested in Islamic law and the preservation of Islamic law, so their attitude did not reach into the question of the environment. This was new to religions. Nobody had to worry about mountains completely disappearing or forests disappearing 500 years ago. There were other problems. So they did not face this problem until much later. But now, in the year 2014, in almost every Islamic country, you have an environmental movement. Of course, Iraq and Syria are under such catastrophic states that nobody can talk about the environment, the invasion of Iraq, the destruction of much of its ecological systems and so forth. The story not told yet for the environment is concerned. But anyway, but countries which are at relative peace, like Morocco, Algeria, in all those countries now, there are environmental movements in the Islamic world.
As somebody who was a founder of that movement, you were at Stockholm in 52, are you happy with the way things are moving now?
No. I'm happy to the extent that they have moved, but it's not really enough. As soon as a little economic crisis comes up, little compared to the history of the world, and much worse than that could happen, like what happened in America at the end of the Bush era and throughout the Obama era, as soon as an economic crisis comes up, people forget about the environment.
Dr. Syed Hossein Nasser is an Iranian-born Islamic scholar and environmentalist. I'm Paul Kennedy, and you're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1, cbc.ca, and on Sirius XM. If you'd like to sign up for our podcast, you can do that at our website, cbc.ca/ideas. And you can also let us know your thoughts about anything you've heard on the show on Facebook and or on Twitter. When you hear the words Muslim or Islam in the popular media, they're often, too often, in the context of extremism and terrorism. That's one of the many reasons why we wanted to hear from Dr. Nasser, to find out what lessons a faith tradition like Islam may hold for anyone when it comes to our relationship with nature. And that's where his background in the history of science and religion provided some insight.
Islam was never secularized as Christianity was. Although in the 18th century there began the so-called reformist movements leading to Wahhabism and things like that, which whittled down the reality of religion, but did not secularize it completely. The Islamic worldview never was challenged in the way that the Christian worldview was, to secularize it. Once a Christian, a good friend of mine, was saying that, you know, the difference between you and us is that in the West, there are many people who do not hear the voice of God anymore. I've met Muslims who do not heed the voice of God. I've never met a Muslim who does not hear his voice. This is a comment that was made to me by a very profound French Catholic philosopher. It was quite profound. That is, the Muslims did not lose faith in the same way that what happened in the Christian West. Now a few people are found here and there, but they're an extremely small minority. So you had a very different dynamic in the phenomenon of coming to deal with nature. Now, since all of these major events which were helping in the destruction of nature and the environment were taking place in the West, and the Islamic world, like the rest of the world, was simply trying to catch up with the errors of the West. Of course, they would never put it in this sense. They're trying to catch up, period. They catch up with what? With either the leftovers of the breadcrumbs of the Western table or with the errors that the West was making. So if the West was polluting rivers, we would pollute the same. Instead, the West would find the solution. I mean, I speak as a person who's spoken in Pakistan and India and not only my own country, many, many countries about this issue. And always the argument is, oh, the West has called these problems, they're omnipotent, omniscient. They'll find the solution, we'll get it from them. That's the attitude of most people who are under inferiority complex, which includes almost all the East, with a few exceptions here and there. And that's why, in fact, the minorities living in America, Muslim minorities, can play such an important role in the future for the rest of the Islamic world. But I will not get into that. But anyway, in the Islamic world, didn't seem to be a problem. When I was living in Tehran, the population of Tehran was 300,000, and you could see Mount Damavand, the highest peak in Western Asia, 19,000 foot, beautiful Mount Damavand, from the roof of our house. Now you can't even see your cousin's house next to the room because of the pollution, not to talk about Mount Damavand. At that time, nobody realized what was coming about. And so the waking up to this crisis has been much, much slower. And there have been exceptions. Sheikh Keftaru, who was the Grand Mufti of Syria before this great tragedy befell this wonderful country, he died. He was a real environmentalist. It was amazing. He was a Grand Mufti. I was a very good friend of mine, and I'm not a mufti, I'm not a religious figure in that sense. I have a lot of freedom to say things but that people don't. But he always was a Grand Mufti of Syria, was a person who spoke in these terms. And he wanted the mullahs on Fridays to preach about the environment in mosques all the time. But here a great problem came up in the Islamic world, which the West does not have. And that is that almost every Islamic country, what the preachers preach on Friday is ordered by the government. The Friday sermons are closely watched and controlled. Now, one of the things these governments do not like is anything that would stultify what they believe to be economic progress. And so there is a very strong opposition in order to be able to bring up environmental issues. I'm not saying this is 100%. I didn't say that. But it's much stronger than in the West. I mean, a minister preaching on some Sunday morning, even in North Carolina, if he gets up and talks about that God doesn't want you to destroy his nature, he's not going to be put into prison. Whereas somebody saying something like that in Cairo, maybe that might be his last sermon. So you have this problem, it's a practical problem. The practical problem is extremely important because although most Muslim governments don't really care whether there's economic progress or not, they just want to remain in power. But to remain in power, they have to talk about economic progress. And so anyone who tries to stop the so-called jump forward is then opposed by political forces. But on a deeper level, the Islamic world has a much easier path than does the Christian world in dealing with the environmental crisis.
Dr. Nasser, what, in your opinion, positions Islam to be in a better relationship with nature today than the Christianity, the kinds of Christians that you describe in the talk?
First of all, let me make it clear that the pollution of Islamic cities today is not better than that of the West. In fact, the West is a bit better than the Islamic world. The Cairo, Karachi, Tehran have a lot more pollution problems than even London, which is a very big city, not quite as big as Cairo, but very big city. That has to do also with poverty, the migration of many people from the countryside into big city, things like that, which occurred in the West in the 19th century. The situation is, in a sense, on the ground, even worse than it is in the West. But Islam has one great advantage over Christianity as a religion. And that is that, first of all, the classical formulations of Christianity, going back to the church fathers, was based on the idea of creating a religion of love, which would answer the naturalism of the Greek religion, which had destroyed religion in the antiquity. So Christianity began as a religion of love, and always says God is love, and it developed a theology of nature on the side of this. Whereas Islam, from the very beginning, was a religion of knowledge. To be saved is to know what reality is. And the testament of Islam, La ilaha illallah, there is no divinity but God, is a statement of knowledge. Not that love is absent from Islam any more than knowledge is absent from Christianity. It's a question of emphasis. So Islam developed from the very beginning, going back to the Quran, a great deal of attention to the world of nature, to God's creation.
In the lecture, you actually spoke about a friend of yours who told you that Christians no longer actually hear the voice of God. Well, Muslims do. I have to say that when I hear that, certain alarm bells go off. I know that a lot of people are sort of afraid of people having religious certainty, people knowing, having the ear of God, I suppose, that it creates religious absolutes and that such absolutes can be very dangerous, as we see in parts of the Middle East, basically around the world now, where fundamentalists are doing things that aren't particularly nice.
First of all, the fundamentalists are the last people to claim to have heard the voice of God. Let me say that too. In fact, they don't believe that at all.
Well, where do they get what they're certainty
They believe
from?
They're following the voice of God that the prophet heard and is in the Quran, except they're misinterpreting it. When I said hearing the voice of God, and this was a Christian who told me, was on a question of everyday prayer and relation with God in everyday life. There's so many people in the West who no longer hear the voice of God in their heart. And this Christian friend who said that to me was that there's so few people in the West who have this intimate relation with God. That's what he really meant. The result of it is that when you go to a mosque on Fridays in Cairo or in Istanbul, grand mosque with that 10,000 people inside, 10,000 people in the street saying the Friday prayers. When you go to the biggest cathedrals in Europe, see how many people are praying there on Sundays. Gradually, so many people in the West have either rejected that there is such a thing as the voice of God, or that they hear it.
I wasn't actually talking about the sort of profound and sincere direction and relationship with God, more about zealotry, I suppose. And I know in the past you've been critical of a group, including the Oxford geneticist Richard Dawkins, the American writer Sam Harris, the late Christopher Hitchens, all of whom are card-carrying atheists. I'm wondering, though, if you share just a little bit of their concern about the fact that religious zealotry leads to barbarism almost wherever it happens.
Yes, it does. Zealotry is part of human history. Except in societies in which religion is strong, it takes on a religious color. It's not caused by religion. Religion is made as an excuse to extend zealotry. And when it's combined with religious fervor, it becomes a terrible concoction, very, very dangerous, which unfortunately we see before us mostly in the Islamic world, but not uniquely in the Islamic world.
I'm curious about whether you have personally encountered the Islamic form of that absolutism or that zealotry.
Yes, I've had some personal contact, but not with the severe type of warrior-like people who are fighting battles in fields. I've never met those. But I met some of their ideological leaders, you might say, people who talk about these things. Yes, I have.
Do they consider you a friend or an enemy?
Depends. They're polite usually. I've never met someone who really attacked me, but I do not think, for example, people who had a Wahhabi Salafi outlook consider me as a friend. But since also I'm an Islamic scholar in the West, and they know that my writings have explained Islam to many people, they did not attack me very much. But for example, in Saudi Arabia, some of my books are banned because they're too philosophical.
I'm Paul Kennedy, and you're listening to an episode of Ideas we're calling Islam and the Environment. You don't often hear those two words in the same breath, but for Islamic scholar Dr. Syed Hossein Nasser, they're inseparable. In my conversation with Dr. Nasser, I wanted to delve further into the idea of being too philosophical and the huge issue of the relationship between theology and scientific truth. So I mentioned to him how another famous spiritual leader sees that relationship. The Dalai Lama was asked at Harvard, in fact, what he would do if Buddhist teachings were ever contradicted by science. And his answer was, well, we'd have to change our religious teachings. What if scientific findings ever contradicted a tenet in Islam? What would you do?
I wouldn't do what the Dalai Lama said, although he's a good friend of mine. I have a lot of respect for him. First of all, so-called findings of modern science. What do we mean by that? A lot of so-called findings are extrapolations of, let's say, terrestrial physics to astrophysics, the life of the universe, things like that, are all based on presumptions. I'm totally opposed to changing religion to harmonize with science. Why doesn't science change to harmonize with religion? What is this inferiority complex we have developed? If religion comes from God and we believe in God, science is a purely human construct, why is it that we have to change the divine knowledge for a human construct? So, of course, my view is a minority view. If it were a majority view, we would have another kind of civilization.
I would love to be a fly on the wall for your conversation with the Dalai Lama on this issue.
I have discussed it with him once or twice. The most extensive was in India. And there, Dalai Lama showed his metaphysical knowledge, which I learned as a Lama in Tibet. And usually in the West, he doesn't talk in that vein. He talks about general morality and being good and the Buddhist virtues of compassion and so forth. But there he spoke metaphysically, and we had a wonderful discussion about this. If ever this takes place between myself and him, you can be sitting there. I'll invite you. Come and sit down and listen to what we have to say.
I'll bring a microphone.
All right. All right.
Here's hoping that one day I receive that invitation. In the meantime, let's hear more from Dr. Nasser, this time on the relationship between nature and poetic expression.
Islamic poetry, Persian, Arabic, Urdu, Sindhi, all the different languages, are full of nature poetry, which are not nature poetry as we call it in English, because we consider oftentimes to be secularized. Christians didn't like nature poetry usually. They're profoundly religious by nature poetry, like Bejahan Khurramazan and Bejahan Khurramazust. That is a very famous poem of Saadi. It's very beautiful poems in the Persian language and similar ones in Arabic and so forth. Our culture was impregnated from the very beginning by a refusal to separate nature and supernature. This is one of the weaknesses of classical Christian theology, which made the secularization of nature so easy in the West.
In the lecture, you talked about a poem, a very famous poem. Can you recite some of that poem for us right now?
Yes, it was a poem of Saadi, I think. I think that's the poem you have in mind.
Yep.
بجهان خرمزانم که جهان خرمزوست. عاشقم بر همه عالم که همه عالم ازوست.
What basically would that translate as?
It's that I'm joyous with the world, for the world belongs to him. I love the whole world, for the world is his, referring to God.
What does that poem mean to you?
I memorized this poem when I was 5, 6 years old. And it means that the love of God entails the love of his creation, the love of nature, the love of beauty in nature, from the face of a beautiful woman to a beautiful bird, to a tree, to a little puppy, to a lion, to the beautiful mountains. In my whole life, I've never disassociated the beauty of the natural world, the beauty of the human being, both inward and outward, and the beauty of God. And beauty and love go together. Islam emphasizes perhaps beauty over love, Christianity, love over beauty. But they always go together. And I've always therefore loved God's creation in the same way that he has allowed me to love him. I've never ceased to love God since I was a child, and I hope inshallah I will die, God willing, I will die without ever ceasing to love him.
Was there one single moment in your life when you felt close to God, close to nature, and seen how the two of them were actually connected?
Yes, more than once. These are very intimate experiences. I really do not want to talk about them in public, but I had a kind of what might call it, say, a cosmic experience of being in the bosom of nature, both in Iran and in America. A kind of theophany was revealed to me about the world of nature and combined with the presence of God. Yes, I've had that experience.
In the lecture, you actually referred to sometimes when you were at MIT and you would go out to Concord to Walden Pond and walk around the pond at 1 or 2 or 3 in the morning. Did you share there the kinds of experience that Henry David Thoreau had when he was living at Walden?
That's right. The Walden Pond was not very far from our house in Arlington, which was north of Cambridge in Massachusetts. And in the evening, there was nobody there. And alone in the woods, I would walk around the lake. And of course, I read Walden by Thoreau. But it wasn't to follow his experience. It was to be alone in God's nature.
You know, it's very strange, but you could have almost seen me running around the pond, which I used to do at that time of day.
That was after my time, I guess. Good, I'm glad we shared this together.
It's an amazing
place. All the
trees
you saw while you were running around the pond, I had seen also. I never liked to jog. I thought you either should run or walk. But I did a lot of walking instead of your jogging there.
What Thoreau called it was sauntering. You're supposed to saunter.
That's exactly, exactly. I just am sauntering.
There's a web that connects us all to God. And that is not only human beings, all creatures. كُلُّ شَيْءٍ يُسَبَّحُ بِحَمْدِهِ, the Quran says. It's not only us. كُلُّ شَيْءٍ, all things. Him, the praise of God. And so there is this community that we share with all creatures. Birds are called communities in the Quran. It's not only the community in Vancouver or Toronto of human beings. Bees, birds, everything has its own community. And it's so easy to develop an authentic Islamic philosophy of the environment.
I'm curious about whether an authentic Islamic philosophy, the environment, is exclusive. And I mean by that does Islam have something that other traditions, other faiths don't have, and maybe even can't have, because they're not Islamic?
Every religion has both general principles concerning nature, which are universal, and particular instructions which pertain to themselves alone. Let me take the case of Islam and Hinduism. There are certain general principles about the sacredness of nature, about the presence of divine influence, although expressed in different language in Hinduism and Islam. But also, for example, in Hinduism, most of all Brahmins and most others are vegetarians, and cows are sacred, whereas in Islam they are not. And the eating of meat does not destroy the harmony between man and nature. But on the highest level, they join together. Now, what is important for the world, as far as the Islamic view of the environment is concerned, is that here is an Abrahamic religion. Its structure is very similar to Christianity and Judaism. And of the three Abrahamic religions, it is the one which spoke most from the very beginning about the spiritual significance of nature, long before the environmental crisis came about. There is some in Jewish writing, there is some in Christian writing, but much more central in Islamic writing. And it can play an important role in a revival of interest in these matters for Christians and Jews. Secondly, Islam does not only exist in relation to Christianity and Judaism. It exists in relation to Hinduism in India, to Confucianism in China, and Buddhism in that country, and so forth. And so the revival of, an Islamic environmental philosophy in China, in Chinese, by Chinese Muslims, there are 100 million Chinese Muslims, could have a very important role in what's going on in China right now, which is interest in the revival of new Confucian and Confucian philosophy of nature. And this is going on right now.
Dr. Nasser, it's wonderful to talk to you, and one of the most fabulous aspects of it is to hear you describe, I guess, some of the epiphanies, some of the enlightenments that you've discussed in your lifetime. I'm curious, though, to almost take it in the other direction. And those were all positive epiphanies. You were talking about a cosmic consciousness. Was there a time that you faced the void, a time when you sort of understood really searing doubt and didn't know where it was going to take you?
Yes, once in my life.
Once?
That is one period in my life, not one day. From the age of 16, 17, I began to have doubts about the religious view of the universe, not about God himself. I never doubted God. There was no day in my life in which I ceased to believe in God, but about the religious view of the universe. And it was this that led stage by stage to the great spiritual crisis I had at the age of 19, when I was a sophomore at MIT, pondering over the philosophical questions about the nature of reality, about what is the universe, where am I, where am I going, is there life after death, what is the meaning of the soul, the most fundamental questions of philosophy and theology. And all of that crisis came to an end when I discovered the traditional worldview and I adopted it as my own. I saw this was the truth and that was it.
You had that crisis and yet you maintained your career in science, at least as an undergraduate.
That's right. This was due to the discipline that my father had given me. I wanted to leave MIT, leave America, leave the West, leave the world, not even go back to Iran, disappear somewhere in some island. But my father had given me a great deal of intellectual discipline as a child, and I thought I should stick it out, which I did.
The environmental crisis itself, for those who really have eyes to see, is both the proof of God's transcendence and the proofs of the interconnectedness of all beings. John Donne wrote, "No man is an island." We human beings are not an island unto ourselves. We cannot be happy without the happiness of the rest of creation. We have killed enough, massacred enough of God's other creatures. Now is the time to pay. And as a kind of Yom al-Qiyamah for all of us. And God will judge us in the future whether we are able to live in harmony and peace with the rest of his creation or commit suicide. There is no third choice. Thank you.
Islamic scholar and environmentalist Dr. Syed Hossein Nasser, speaking to a packed Ismaili center in Burnaby, British Columbia. You ended the talk in Burnaby by saying, God will judge us in the future on whether we live in harmony with nature or commit suicide. If that future day were to happen right now, what do you think God's judgment would be?
God judges each person individually. God does not judge a whole society en masse, although he can punish a society en masse for due to the preponderance of evil, as the Quran and the Bible talk about all the time. It would be actually that a number of people would be judged positively by God, but many of us would not. The fact that we're dream walkers, we do not think about the consequences of our actions, the way we destroy the environment to fulfill what we call our needs, but they're not real needs, our wants, which are much of which is based on passion, and they're not our real needs, impervious to not only others who might be poor, but to the world of nature. In this day and age, I feel much more sensitive when a bird is killed than when a human being is killed sometimes. This is a difficult thing to say, but it's we human beings who have corrupted the earth, as the Quran says, by our forgetting who we are, why we are on earth, what we're doing here, why, what is the meaning of life, where are we going? We have forgotten that. And through our very living, even peacefully walking on the sidewalk, we're destroying the earth. But through that very electricity that we're using, or the water that we're using, or the extra clothing that we're wearing, we are, in fact, coming soon to a kind of judgment by God. Because if we do not change our ways, not only the few who are trying, but societies as a whole, and the West must take the lead because the rest of the world is following the West. Unless we change our ways drastically, adopt another worldview, we are going to face what, from an outward point of view, would be a major crisis, but from a religious point of view, a divine judgment. Of course, most environmentalists do not believe in religious language of day of judgment, God's judgment, and things like that, but it will be divine judgment upon us. And therefore, I think we are all responsible, each in our own way, to try to remember that the earth was not made only for us, but for all the birds and trees and creatures of the deep of the sea, or the creatures on the land, and that we must be able to live in such a way that we can live in harmony with them. Not the question of progress, having more and more changing cars every year, bringing all the seal out of the earth, every last drop of oil, to all of these things that we are doing, destroying national parks by the pressure of oil companies to drill, all of these things, we cannot continue without paying a very, very heavy price. And woe unto us if we do not do it. And especially sad that many of the people who do this do not have even anywhere to go. At least traditional societies believe that they would go to heaven or hell or somewhere. Most people do not even know, from the point of modern science, there's nowhere to go. The universe is going to die anyway. And so from one point of view, if you really accept modern science, the environmental crisis is meaningless because the earth is going to be destroyed in a few million years. So what if it's destroyed a few million years earlier?
Dr. Nasser, you're a man of faith, but I wonder if you're an optimist or a pessimist.
I don't believe in this, either optimism or pessimism, but since you brought that this category, in the long run, I'm an optimist. And I believe with medieval European sages, omnia veritas, the truth
is everything.
I believe in the truth. Ultimately, therefore, I'm an optimist. But in the short run, I'm a pessimist.
Dr. Nasser, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome. Bye.
On Ideas, Islam, and the Environment with Dr. Syed Hossein Nasser. He now teaches in the Department of Religion at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. You can download the podcast by going to our webpage, cbc.ca/ideas. This program was produced by David Gutnick. Thanks to Ali Lakhani, Fareed Damji, and the Ismaili Center in Burnaby, British Columbia. The associate producer of Ideas is Liz Naj. Technical production, Dave Field in Toronto and Patrick Ferguson in Washington. The executive producer of Ideas is Greg Kelly. I'm Paul Kennedy. The news is next.